Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for April 29th. Up first is Sean Speer and Taylor Jackson, writing on just how bad Canada's defense spending problem is. Downright disastrous, with little hope in sight.
The current state of Canada's military and defense spending has been the subject of international criticism and a source of growing isolation from key allies. In a world of evolving geopolitical tensions and new and emerging threats, Canada's underinvestment in national defense represents a major vulnerability. Canadian policymakers seem to increasingly understand this point. Last week, former Conservative Defense Minister Jason Kenney was critical of his past government for failing to boost defense spending. However, while the recent federal budget earmarked incremental spending, though it was back-end loaded, Canada will still fall short of the NATO target of 2% of GDP. One of the inherent challenges to policy thinking concerning Canadian defense policy and military spending is that, as previous Auditor General reports have noted, it's quite challenging to understand the state of defense spending due to various factors, including the Department of National Defense's unique accounting. The purpose of this deep dive is to situate trends with respect to defense spending in a historical context, as well as to discuss the state of Canada's military capabilities and present some of the challenges that the Canadian government will face as it seeks to increase defense spending in an increasingly turbulent world. Historically, Canada was a relatively large spender on national defense. After the end of the Korean War in the early 1950s, Canadian military expenditures peaked at over 7% of GDP before steadily falling to roughly 2% of GDP in the 1980s. Things, however, began to change with two episodes of fiscal consolidation, first under the Chrétien government in the 1990s and then under the Harper government in the 2000s. As a result, defense expenditures fell from 2.11% in 1986 to roughly 1% of GDP by 2014. At the same time, the size of the Canadian Armed Forces, or CAF, was cut by 30% from 90,000 active troops in 1990 to 62,000 in 2005. The force size has remained mostly unchanged ever since. However, 2014 wasn't just an important year for being a low point in post-Second World War defense spending. It's also the year when NATO implemented its much-discussed 2% of GDP defense spending target, marking this as the starting point for our analysis. The origin of the 2% target dates back to 2006, when the notion of a precise spending goal was first mentioned in a NATO document. Yet, a spending pledge would not be formalized until the 2014 NATO summit in Wales, which came on the heels of Russia's invasion of Crimea in the same year. While the focus is often on the overall defense spending target, two spending commitments were actually made in the NATO-Wales summit declaration. Specifically, NATO members pledged to spend both 2% of the GDP on defense, while also ensuring that 20% of their defense budgets are spent on major new equipment purchases, including expenditures related to research and development. The overall goal of the two commitments was to ensure that all NATO allies recognize the need to reverse the trend of declining defense budgets, to make the most effective use of our funds, and to further a more balanced sharing of costs and responsibilities. Our overall security and defense depend both on how much we spend and how we spend it. Increased investments should be directed towards meeting our capability priorities, and allies also need to display the political will to provide required capabilities and deploy forces when they are needed. While the spirit of the NATO commitment was laudable and necessary, the notion of spending targets is not without criticism. The main criticism is that while the 2% target may be beneficial as a political rallying point, it's merely an input metric that tells us nothing about defense outputs like operational readiness, capabilities, tactics, strategy, and overall competency. Instead, critics argue that the alliance and its members should focus more on ensuring that there is adequate force planning, readiness, and fighting capability among alliance members. A more recent criticism is that the 2% target itself is too low in an increasingly dangerous world. For example, Polish President Andrzej Duda has argued that NATO's spending target should be upped to 3% of GDP, given growing concerns about Russian attacks on NATO members. Likewise, last week, UK Defence Secretary Grant Shapps stated that the UK now thinks that the NATO target should be 2.5% of GDP. Although the NATO spending pledges are not without controversy, they are, nevertheless, what alliance members agreed to and thus serve as a baseline for spending analysis. The question then is, how does Canada stack up? Across the period of 2014 to 2023, using figures directly from NATO, Canadian defense spending has risen from 1% of GDP in 2014 to 1.3% by 2023. In real dollar terms, 2015 constant prices, Canadian defense spending rose from $19.9 billion CAD in 2014 to $29.9 billion in 2023. Some of the increased spending, however, needs to be taken with caution. Early in this period, NATO revised its definition of defense spending, making it more flexible to include spending items that were not previously allowed, such as veterans' pensions and benefits. These definitional changes partly explain the increase in Canada's absolute spending. How does Canada compare to the rest of the NATO membership on defense spending relative to the size of their economies? Quite poorly. Out of 30 NATO members for which there is data, Canada ranks the fourth lowest in terms of defense spending relative to the size of its economy, only ahead of Spain, Belgium, and Luxembourg. Note that Iceland and Sweden are not included in the NATO spending figures. Based on the 2023 estimates, only 11 NATO members were meeting the 2% target. However, this is quickly changing, and it could mean that Canada will look even more like a laggard relative to alliance membership. In February 2024, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg reported that 8 alliance members, more than half, were on track to meet the 2% threshold by the end of the year, representing a 6-fold increase since 2014. Canada's performance is even worse if one considers both the 2% spending target in conjunction with the 20% of defense expenditures going to new equipment target. Canada is in the unenviable position of being the only NATO member in 2023 to neither meet its 2% overall defense spending target nor the 20% equipment spending target. 10 members currently meet both. It should be noted that NATO lacks a formal accountability mechanism to ensure that members meet the targets. Informally, states can suffer reputational costs and the recipients of naming and shaming exercises by other alliance members if they don't meet the targets. For example, in February 2024, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg admonished Canada for not meeting the target, stating, "I expect Canada to deliver on the pledge to invest 2% of GDP on defense, because this is a promise we all made." The fact that Canada is the only member of the alliance to not meet either spending target represents both a threat to its international reputation as well as its own defense and security. It prompts the obvious question, what would it have taken for Canada to at least make the 2% of GDP defense spending pledge every year since 2014? Using Canada's defense spending levels and estimates of Canadian real GDP, we estimate that the cumulative real value of Canada's NATO spending gap from 2014 to 2022 is approximately $150 billion in 2017 dollars. That is to say, real spending on defense would have needed to be $150 billion higher in total between 2014 and 2022 to meet Canada's NATO spending pledges in each year, or approximately $16.7 billion each year on average. To put this into perspective, based on the Parliamentary Budget Office's Ready Reckoner tool, which provides estimates of revenue impacts of tax changes, a 1.5 percentage point increase to the GST produces an additional $15 billion in incremental revenues each year, less than what would be required to fund the average annual increase in real defense spending. Canada's defense spending woes are increasingly manifesting as operational issues. Consider first the total size of the CAF. According to estimates provided to NATO, Canada's armed personnel stood at just shy of 67,000 in 2023, making it the 10th largest force among NATO members. However, things look different if you consider force size relative to population. When looking at military personnel as a share of the total population, Canada ranks second last. Indeed, not only is the size of Canada's armed forces small when scaled by population size compared to other NATO members, but internal documents from the Department of National Defense, or DND, are also starting to raise concerns. For example, 2023 documents obtained by the CBC stated that the CAF were short 15,780 members when considering both regular and reserve forces relative to their targets. More troubling in those documents was the internal assessment of equipment readiness. Regarding the Navy's frigates, submarines, Arctic and offshore patrol ships, and maritime coastal defense vessels, 54% were deemed not serviceable, meaning that they were in no state to deploy. For the Air Force's fighters, maritime aviation, search and rescue, tactical aviation, and transport aircraft, 55% were not serviceable. Finally, in the case of the Army's armored fighting vehicles, artillery, combat support vehicles, logistics equipment, combat support vehicles, and logistics equipment, 46% were not serviceable. The report noted that the biggest challenge to having equipment serviced and ready to deploy is personnel, in addition to older equipment being more difficult to maintain. As the Hub's defense expert Richard Shimuka has written, recent funding announcements are being layered onto a military that has hemorrhaged much of its key personnel. Many individuals, who are already overtasked, rightly wonder who will be there to integrate, operate, or sustain these new capabilities. To begin to address some of Canada's defense spending and operational issues, the Trudeau government has pledged to increase defense spending through its 2024 budget and Canada's recently released defense policy update, titled Our North, Strong and Free. This is Canada's first defense policy update since 2017's Strong, Secure, Engaged. Beginning with the 2024 budget, the government plans to increase spending directly for DND from $26.9 billion in 2022 to 2023 to $49.5 billion in 2029 to 2030. This increase in defense spending includes commitments like $30 billion over 20 years for NORAD modernization and $11.5 billion over 20 years for Canada's contribution to increasing NATO's common budget, and establishing a new regional office in Halifax for NATO's Defense Innovation Accelerator for the North Atlantic. It should be noted that using the nominal GDP projections in the budget, the 2028 to 2029 spending of $46 billion is estimated to be about 1.3% of Canada's projected GDP in 2028. This demonstrates the degree to which meeting NATO targets will need to either come from increases in DND's budget or defense-related spending in other ministries. The government's recently released defense policy similarly doesn't include a plan to meet NATO targets. Indeed, the government is only projecting to spend 1.76% of GDP by 2029 to 2030, while indicating that it will meet the 20% equipment spending target. More specifically, the recent defense policy update commits to investing $8.1 billion over the next 5 years and $73 billion over the next 20 years to Canadian defense. While several of the initiatives in the defense policy update are laudable, including efforts to increase recruitment and retention, as well as crucial investments in new equipment, a few things stand out. First, the 1.76% of GDP figure is difficult to verify based on what is in the defense policy and the 2024 budget. For example, while the government provides a fact sheet attempting to explain the 1.76% figure, roughly 15% of Canadian defense spending in 2029 to 2030 is expected to come from other government departments. Yet, it is unclear which departments and which programs are included. The government would do well to be clearer and more transparent about how Canada is planning to get there by the decade's end. Second, most of the planned spending is in the out years, despite Defense Minister Bill Blair stating in early March that Canada's armed forces are in a death spiral when it comes to recruitment. Only $612 million in incremental spending is earmarked for the 2024 to 2025 fiscal year, with an additional $1.1 billion coming in the following year. The majority of the incremental $8.1 billion announced in the defense policy update is not expected to be spent until later years. In addition, of the nearly $73 billion that is to be spent on defense over the next 20 years, only 11% is planned to be spent in the next 5 years. Given the severe concerns about the diminished size of the CAF and its operational readiness raised above, the investments in this plan appear inadequate to make a significant difference in the near term. Furthermore, there are also reasons to question whether the projected increases in defense spending will occur as planned, particularly when focusing on major equipment purchases. It's one thing to earmark spending increases in government spending documents, but it's another to ensure that there is adequate state capacity to turn those investments into the personnel and equipment that Canada's armed forces desperately need. A lot has been written on the reasons behind Canada's successive defense procurement fiascos and failures to meet budget targets. These include a lack of accountability, partisan politics that intervenes to ensure defense spending results in partisan wins, problems with institutional design in the procurement system, misalignment between project costs and defense policy objectives, an opaque combination of cash and accrual budgeting, and bureaucratic politics that sees different ministries and armed forces branches pitted against each other, often with misaligned incentives. The situation has gotten so dire that a 2019 Senate report revealed that based on DND's own analysis, procurement times had reached 16 and a half years by 2010 to 2011, which was 66% greater than in 2004. Unfortunately, several recent reports from Canada's Auditor General give little reassurance that much has changed, finding that several recent initiatives were delayed, over budget, and not meeting timelines. With the state of the CAF and Canada's international commitments in peril, long procurement times mean that the Canadian military will not have the personnel and equipment needed for the threats they face for decades to come. Despite Canada's poor record in meeting its NATO commitments, the situation could get worse in the short term if planned investments are not realized in a timely manner. One of the barriers to addressing the challenges of low defense spending and personnel and equipment issues within the CAF is that, in the past, Canadian voters placed little political value on seeing these issues solved. Successive governments have responded to the lack of political incentives for change with ambivalence towards defense policy. However, the politics of defense policy may be changing. According to polling from Angus Reid in March 2024, a majority of Canadians, 53%, favor either increasing defense spending to meet our NATO commitments or going beyond them. This compares to only 43% holding those views in November 2019. Likewise, 29% of Canadians feel that focusing on military preparedness and presence on the world stage should be our top foreign affairs priority, compared to only 12% in 2015. As we highlighted above, Canada currently does not meet its spending targets, and the CAF is in dire need of new personnel and equipment. Despite new spending promises, Canada will still not meet its spending targets by the decade's end, and there will also likely be several headwinds to realizing those spending goals. However, given the shifting priorities among Canadian voters, it may be time for Canada to work towards ensuring that it meets its international commitments and address the internal challenges that will stand in the way of realizing those goals.
That was a commentary by Sean Spear and Taylor Jackson. Sean Spear is the Hub's editor at large. Taylor Jackson is the Hub's research manager and a PhD student in political science at the University of Toronto. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca. Our second essay is by Abdi Adid and Benjamin Allery, writing on why AI is about to fundamentally transform our legal system, for the better, as part of an excerpt from their book, The Legal Singularity: How Artificial Intelligence Can Make Law Radically Better.
We are on the path to the legal singularity. Advances in technology, especially the improvement and widespread proliferation of artificial intelligence, or AI, are driving us relentlessly down this path. By legal singularity, we mean a stable and complete legal order, capable of addressing and resolving practically all types of legal uncertainty in real time and on demand. Over the coming decades, the emergence of this legal singularity will fundamentally transform our existing legal systems and, with them, our societies. The stakes are high. Navigating the path to the legal singularity safely is necessary for humanity to flourish during the rest of the 21st century and beyond. For society to evolve and leverage these new technologies effectively, we will need to develop an ever deeper and more responsive legal infrastructure. The good news is that the very technologies that are upending our existing practices will also enable us to construct the deeper and more responsive legal infrastructure that is sorely needed. The stability and resilience of the legal singularity will require more adaptability in our legal systems than they exhibit today. Fortunately, if we can get things right, the technology for a profoundly beneficial legal singularity will be in place just as we need it most. This book is the first step towards articulating a vision of a legal singularity and motivating a discussion about its pathways and consequences. The legal singularity is the idea that law will reach functional completeness, in the sense that practically any legal question will have an instantaneous and just resolution. In the legal singularity, the law will be knowable with a high degree of certainty, perhaps not perfect certainty, but practical certainty, for much of human activity. The legal singularity will evolve and be able to absorb and accommodate changes to our social, economic, and technological contexts. If it is successful, it will not be dogmatic. Indeed, the nature of the legal singularity will be to provide quiet confidence that justice will prevail. Disputes will be resolved justly and in the best interests of society. Powerful actors will be held accountable to a greater extent than they are even in today's most advanced legal systems. Weaker parties will have their positions bolstered. The legal singularity will require deliberation, experimentation, wisdom, knowledge, and the cumulative efforts of governments, academia, and industry over the coming years. There will be problems. There will be dead ends. There will be experimentation, failures, and more experimentation. Ultimately, there will be significant progress. The good news is that many efforts are being undertaken even as we write. We aspire to echo and amplify those who seek to leverage technology as a means of improving law. To this, we add our own vision of how technology, ambitious problem-solving, and responsible stewardship will guide law towards the legal singularity. Our goals with this book are threefold. The first is to firmly root the legal singularity in the popular imagination as an idea that we collectively must address to ensure that the world's legal systems undergo changes that are in alignment with humanity's interests as artificial intelligence and machine learning continue to improve. If managed deftly, these technological developments in artificial intelligence and machine learning can and will lead to astounding improvements in social justice and distributive justice and will contribute to widespread human flourishing. This is, of course, an optimistic and ambitious vision. Others have pointed out less rosy possible scenarios. Our view is that those scenarios are avoidable if efforts are undertaken now to help to navigate towards positive outcomes. Our second aim is to press the point that technology-based changes to our legal systems are not simply a possibility to be discussed on a theoretical level by the intellectually curious. It is tempting for many in the legal profession to want to assume that we could simply press pause on technological progress and the concomitant evolution of our legal systems until a sufficiently widespread level of practical confidence and psychological comfort is reached. Many would prefer to defer serious consideration of the uncomfortable topics until they are first convinced that one, the status quo is unsustainable. Two, the kinds of changes that are being driven by technological advances have been thoroughly tested and designed with normative and conceptual coherence. And three, an implementation plan has been devised to accommodate these changes in a manner that will be minimally disruptive to the existing legal order. These instincts are understandable. Unfortunately, the context in which law functions and operates is changing too quickly. Our third and final aim with this book is to join the emerging international movement in academia, government, the judiciary, and civil society, and among actors in the legal system more generally, to secure the safest, wisest, and most effective path to the legal singularity. The forces driving us towards legal singularity are persistent and powerful. There is no off switch to the internet. Computing power looks to continue its exponential growth. The shape of an eventual legal singularity can undoubtedly be influenced for the better by careful monitoring, concerted action, and thoughtfulness, or for the worse, by the abuse of technology to oppress or suppress populations. It is in our collective interest to work to forge and secure the best possible path to legal singularity.
That was a commentary by Abdi Ayed and Benjamin Allery. Abdi Ayed researches and teaches in the areas of civil procedure, torts, and law and technology. Benjamin Allery is a graduate of the University of Toronto and Yale Law School and began his career as a law clerk for Madame Justice Louise Arbour. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.